Blog Talk Radio.
It's time to strap our boots on. This is a perfect day to die. Wipe the blood out of our eyes. In this life there's no surrender, and there's nothing left for us to do. Find the strength to see this through. We are the ones who will never be broke.
Hello, folks, and thank you for coming to Bars Logic Political Talk, the grassroots We the People show. And tonight we'll have a very special guest, Morton Blackwell, to discuss the RNC meeting. And we will talk about the meeting itself, its aftermath, and how the events that unfolded will affect the grassroots conservative Republicans. And we will also have later on this evening James Naver, who is the founder of Overpasses for Obama's Impeachment, to give us an update, including a story of Brian Summers and his arrest during one of those events in Fresno, California. Brian is a 23-year-old veteran of the Iraq War, and he also served in Basra, Iraq, in the 1st Infantry, can't even get that out, division as a combat medic in supporting the Operation Iraqi Freedom and Operation New Dawn. But first, of course, we will have Morton Blackwell on the show, and we do have him on the line. Thank you very much, Morton, for coming on the show. How are you?
I'm doing well this evening. I hope you are, too.
Great. Thank you very much. And then, folks, after the show, just check out the Bards Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Go to the Give page because there's some great organizations for you to check out, namely the Angel Heart Farm, who help out children with chronic and life-threatening illnesses and try to help them cope with what they're going through. And so we'll go ahead and start off with our questions we have here, and I appreciate you giving us the hour that you will give us tonight, Morton, and I want to thank you for that. So we'll get right to it. First, you know, I'd like to get some generalities out of the way about the meeting and then move on to more specifics. So, you know, a lot of folks listening in tonight or listening to the archives have already been following some of what has happened at the meeting. So if you could tell me what your overall opinion of the results of the meeting, let's start off there.
Well, the meeting was a success in many ways. A lot of talks were given. A lot of applause was there. The Republican Party is doing well, raising money, doing better than the Democratic National Committee is doing. My guess is that you've called me to discuss matters that relate to the rules of the Republican Party, which is a matter of long interest and long participation by me.
And that's definitely the more specifics that I do want to get into tonight. those.
Okay. Well, when you're talking rules and procedures, you get pretty deep into the weeds, and you can overwhelm people with details. And I'll try to make it as clear as I can. The Republican National Committee is composed of three members from each of the states, the District of Columbia, and the territories. That's a total of 57 parties, three members each, and the total number is 168. That's the total voting membership, three per state and territory. I guess it's 56 total. Three times six is 18. And the Republican National Committee has a standing committee on rules, which meets every time the Republican National Committee meets. And the purpose of the standing committee on rules is to review the rules of the Republican Party passed at the last convention and make proposals for changing those rules. And historically, there was no way to change the rules between Republican national conventions. So the Standing Committee on Rules, 56 potential votes, people would meet and discuss it, and then a few days before the National Convention in presidential election years, the Standing Committee on Rules finalizes its report and makes its recommendations for changes. Those changes historically were considered by the full National Committee, which could make whatever changes it chose to make. And then the next day, the Republican National Committee's report on the rules was handed over to the Convention Rules Committee, which is composed of two members per state elected by the respective delegations to the Republican National Convention. And the Convention Committee on Rules could make whatever amendments, additions, deletions, whatever, it chose, and the report of the Convention Rules Committee is then presented to the Republican National Convention, and on most occasions is simply approved in a voice vote by the National Convention. I've been present at two national conventions where there were rules battles that were fought on the floor of the National Convention. One of them was a fight over the delegate allocation formula, provoked by Senator Jacob Javits and Senator Chuck Percy in 1972, and the conservative forces rallied and defeated what Javits and Percy wanted. And then the only other time there's been a floor battle at the National Convention was in 1976, when the Reagan forces were trying to wrest the nomination away from President Gerald Ford, and a change of the rules was proposed which would have required presidential candidates to name their running mate before the nominations began at the convention, and that was a move designed to hamper a process which was very helpful to President Ford. He had given many prominent state leaders, governors and senators, the idea that they were on his short list to be running mates, and that held their delegations together, whereas if he had had to name his running mate, you would have had a number of very disappointed people, and their delegations would not have remained solidly for Gerald Ford. That proposed amendment by the Reagan people was very narrowly defeated, and that was the decisive vote at the 1976 convention. But from then on, what the Convention Rules Committee decides has been accepted by a voice vote of the convention.
And to my understanding, actually, with our show that we had last week, I was talking to a gentleman who pointed out that actually voting for the vice president on the same ticket as the president is actually not in the Constitution. It's actually not constitutional to have a vice president on the same ticket. They're supposed to be voted for separately, through my understanding, at least through the conversation we had last week. But you had a resolution that you brought to the committee, and I believe this is the multiple times you've done so, in the rules. What was the purpose of the resolution?
Well, I've got to go back to the Tampa convention last year.
Okay.
The Standing Committee on Rules had proposed a number of rules changes, a number of which were constructive and helped open up the party so that power could flow from the bottom up rather than being imposed from the top down. the Republican National Committee accepted its Standing Committee on Rules proposal without amending it at all. It was unanimously approved by the Republican National Committee. And the next day, the Convention Rules Committee began, a guy named Ben Ginsburg, a delegate from the District of Columbia, who had for a long time previous been on the legal staff at the Republican National Committee, was designated by the Romney campaign to lead their forces on the Rules Committee. And he was extraordinarily active. It has long been a tradition that the presidential candidate who's about to be nominated keeps his hands off the rules process, because the rules,
right.
The rules being passed essentially are to control the convention 4 years later. And the guy who's about to get the nomination really doesn't have anything to worry about with respect to the rules ordinarily, because if he is elected president, he's not going to have any trouble from the Republican National Committee 4 years later. But this was the great exception, a very bad precedent in my judgment. I was frankly shocked at what was done, and what Ben Ginsburg did, representing himself as the Romney leader, was himself, or by people whom he had put up to it and who strongly supported him, came up with a great number of amendments, repealed those few reforms which had been passed by the Standing Committee on Rules and the RNC, and then proceeded to introduce one by one a number of new things with the force of the presidential nominee-to-be behind them, and got what he wanted in virtually every instance. And the common thread in the amendments which Ben Ginsburg got passed was to centralize power within the party and to make it more difficult for power to flow from the bottom up.
Right.
It was an outrageous thing that he did. There was an immediate outpouring of rage from people who believe that the Republican Party should be open at the bottom and should be welcoming to new people who become involved in the party. And the result of all those power grabs was that when the Rules Committee report was presented to the convention, the chair of the convention at the time was John Boehner, Speaker of the House, whose person in that position is traditionally chairing much of the National Convention. He presented the Rules Committee report, and there was a voice vote, and there was an enormous outpouring of no votes. I've never seen or heard anything like it, and I've been going to all the national conventions since 1964, when I was Barry Goldwater's youngest elected delegate. So I have a long experience at this. And the yeas and the nays were very close.
Mm-hmm.
Whether or not you thought the yes votes had it or the no votes had it, to a large part was determined by where you were in the convention hall. It was extraordinarily close, but Boehner ruled that the ayes have it.
And mm-hmm. It was on the teleprompter.
Business went on. Well, it's true, it's on the teleprompter. Well, it is true also that Republican National Conventions, and frankly, meetings of the Republican National Committee themselves, are often almost entirely scripted, and it is put on the teleprompter. And I tell you, I was surprised that the vote was very close, and I have no doubt that Speaker Boehner was surprised too, that it was very close. But in any case, the Rules Committee report was passed. One of the worst of the power grabs, which Ben Ginsburg initiated, and that was by motion of John Ryder, the National Committee Man of Tennessee, to introduce a new Rule 12, into the rules of the Republican Party, which provides that for the first time ever, the national rules give the Republican National Committee the right to make amendments to many of the rules of the party between conventions. There's a requirement that changes in this fashion be passed by the Standing Committee on Rules by a majority vote, and then a 75% vote of the entire Republican National Committee is required to change the rules between conventions, and the ability of the RNC to change rules goes to September of 2014, and after that, the Republican National Committee no longer has any power to change the rules before the convention. So that's what happened at the convention, at the Republican National Committee meeting this winter in Los Angeles. I presented a motion in the Standing Committee on Rules to repeal all of the changes that had been made by the Convention Rules Committee, that the RNC has any authority over. There, some of them that Rule 12 exempted.
Mm-hmm.
There was considerable grassroots support for that. My motion got the support of 25 states, but the balance of the states and the territories voted against this omnibus repeal of the Ginsburg power grabs and everything else that the Rules Committee did, because it was wrong what was done, and in my judgment, nothing like that should ever happen again. It was a terrible power grab that outraged people, and it hurt Romney.
Oh, I think it was a big cause of him losing in 2012.
Well, the Republican state chairman of my state said that it probably cost 100,000 votes just in Virginia, and we were a state that narrowly carried for Obama. Anyhow, you don't have a convention where half the people in the convention hall are furiously mad without it hurting the nominee, which really is validating the judgment made by previous candidates who were about to get nominated in earlier conventions, that they kept their hands off of the rules process, because what you're going to do is aggravate people, and you ought to let the grassroots process function and not show that you're going to try to boss everybody around, and particularly not aggravate people by trying to concentrate power.
Mm-hmm.
So anyhow, because my amendment didn't pass at the Los Angeles meeting, I decided to go after just one of the Ginsburg power grabs, but one that is extremely important to grassroots conservatives. More than 20 years, there has been a concern in the Republican Party that many states were trying to front load the delegate selection process by holding their primaries that bind their state's delegate votes earlier and earlier. And the party sets a deadline, has tried with only some success to set deadlines and a time frame in which delegates can be selected. And so more and more states were holding winner-take-all primaries earlier and earlier in the process, and we were coming closer and closer to what amounted to a national presidential primary, which is a very bad idea for the Republican Party, a bad idea for the United States of America. There needs to be a reasonable time where people within a party can observe the presidential candidates who are running for the nomination and judge them in a spread out series of contests in a wide variety of geographical and political circumstances to test them. And from the grassroots perspective, if you have all the all or almost all of the delegates selected on one day, or in a period of a few days, you get a majority of the delegates selected, you wind up giving an enormous advantage to extremely wealthy candidates, because in the normal course of things, it's often possible for a candidate who is an excellent candidate, who starts off without a lot of money, but has qualities which become clear during the nomination contest, and that person can accumulate more donors and more supporters and go on to win. There's also the problem that the Republican Party faces a largely hostile national media, which has demonstrated on many occasions that they can influence the Republican presidential contest by lionizing and celebrating somebody whose views are frankly contrary to the grassroots conservative opinion, which would otherwise dominate the process, given time to for it to have its effect. So there are all these reasons why it was a bad idea, and we had adopted and had in effect in the 2012 election a rule which set March the 1st as the earliest time when states could hold primaries, except for the certain traditional states which were allowed to go outside that window, and those states in 2012 were the familiar states of New Hampshire and Iowa and South Carolina and Nevada. But the rule said, it turned out to be Rule 16C2, that a state that held its primary or bound its delegates in March would have to allocate its delegates in some way proportional to the vote in the primary, which would prevent people from anybody from winning the plurality of the vote and getting all the delegates and piling up an insurmountable lead. And that is a very important rule. I don't like putting any restrictions on the, states and state parties to determine the rules by which they elect their delegates, except to assure that there's fairness in the process. But this was important because we were moving ever closer to having a national primary. So that was what the rule was. Ben Ginsburg pushed through an amendment to change the wording. The wording said that states that select their delegates in March shall allocate their delegates by some proportional means. And he just changed one word in that rule and changed it from shall to say they may allocate their delegates proportionally to the vote in the primary, which of course totally destroyed the effect of the rule and gave no reason for any state that wanted to have a winner-take-all primary to not have it as early as possible in March.
And this is the resolution you came up with,
my
right?
proposed change mm-hmm. at this recent meeting last week in Boston was that we change the word may back to the word shall and reinstate the prohibition on winner-take-all primaries in March. States would have the right to hold winner-take-all primaries in April or thereafter in the nomination season. What happened at the Standing Committee on Rules, which was the first step in this process, was I was allowed to stand up and make my proposal, which I had communicated in a timely fashion to the national chairman and the national secretary and to all the other members of the Republican National Committee. And after I made my motion, I believe it was John Ryder of Tennessee, moved that my amendment be referred to a special subcommittee, and the vote was overwhelming to do that. A lot of people stood up and said that they much supported my proposal. They thought my proposal was a great idea, but that it would be a good idea to refer all changes to this special appointed committee.
Mm-hmm. And that's a committee of like 10 members,
so,
correct?
So it wasn't at all clear whether my motion would have passed. I think it would have passed there. But in any case, people who said they supported it voted to refer it to committee. And there were a couple of other duly offered amendments which were also referred to that committee, which at some point, unscheduled as yet, will have meetings and then at some point make a report to the Standing Committee on Rules. So that's the current status, and I'm sorry it was so complex.
No, that's okay.
If anybody's going to be able to follow this, they need the whole story.
No, I agree. I agree, and thank you very much. And actually, that was a good segue into the third question, because you already answered the second one and how your resolution was handled. And tell us about the change to refer the proposed amendments to the 10-member subcommittee, which the members of the subcommittee are handpicked, after my understanding, by Lynn Priebus and a Rules Committee chairman.
Well, I'm not sure who compiled the list. I can assure you that I didn't have any input on it, and I certainly wasn't put on it myself. But I thought it was a bad idea for there to be a special subcommittee, because that special subcommittee is going to do only what the Standing Committee on Rules itself is intended to do. That's the business of the Standing Committee on Rules, and it eliminated input from a majority of the states in that process.
And also, do you think that having the just a 10-member subcommittee prohibits any kind of transparency and prohibits discussion on such proposed amendments?
Well, we had a very interesting confrontation with respect to transparency after the rules amendments were put off into a subcommittee. The next item on the agenda was the discussion of rules 1 through 11 of the 45 or so rules of the National Committee. That's the way the Standing Committee on Rules tends to operate. We take up the rules and we discuss them, and then people propose amendments, and they are debated and voted on and eventually become part of the report of the Standing Committee just before the next national convention. John Ryder, now general counsel of the general counsel of the Republican National Committee, moved that we go into executive session. And there was a quick voice vote on it, and we went into executive session. And then there was considerable discussion after the vote as to whether or not it was good to be in executive session, and support for the executive session collapsed, and we went out of executive session and proceeded to discuss things. It was established and announced at the Stand Committee on Rules that the meetings of the subcommittee are going to be open to other members of the committee, and I was specifically told that I would be welcome to be present, but I don't know that I would have any right to talk, and certainly I wouldn't have any right to vote on it. It is interesting that the rules of the Republican Party have for many years required that meetings of the standing committee shall be open to the public, and thus an executive session really was contrary to the national rules of the party. And I don't think we're going to have another motion soon for the Standing Committee on Rules to go into an executive session, because support for it collapsed pretty dramatically.
And real quick, I want to grab a question I have here from some folks here in chat. I'd like to draw some questions from there. And Arlen asks, have they been dismantled? I'm starting to talk about the 2012 remaining power grab rules. That's one. And two, have they been dismantled? And is there a positive prognosis for removing any of these, of the power grab?
Well, as a matter of fact, there was one minor change of one of the Ginsburg power grabs, and it was changed by an overwhelming vote. It was a good change to make, but it was minor. The major power grabs are still in effect. Virtually everything that Ginsburg got passed is still in effect and needs to be changed. And as far as the prognosis, what is going to happen down the way, I don't know. I think that the grassroots conservatives and libertarians are paying more attention to the rules now between conventions than ever before in the history of the party. Many members of the Republican National Committee told me in Boston that they had received lots of communications from people in their states. I've worked on the rules diligently for many, many years, and there's never been a peep of publicity about anything. It's been inside a ball game, but that's not the current case. I think people are concerned about it.
Right.
What happened in Tampa was very wrong. It needs to be repudiated. We need to give clear evidence to grassroots people who are considering becoming active in the Republican Party that they're going to be welcome. As I said repeatedly, if we want the Republican Party to grow, we have got to treat newcomers fairly, politely, and if possible, cordially. It may very well be that matters that relate to the rules and how people on the National Committee are currently voting with respect to the rules will become more widely known across the country, and it could be that members of the committee will be held accountable for how they voted with respect to rules.
Well, I think so. I think a lot of folks would see that. And just for people who are in the chat or listening out there, if they'd like to chime in or ask some questions of Mr. Blackwell here, you can call in at 347-945-7428. And I do see some folks in there on the switchboard already, so just push 1 on your number dial. If you have any questions you'd like to ask, we'll be opening up the mics If anyone likes to ask any questions, in about 15 minutes, I do have a few more questions here I'd like to ask Mr. Blackwell and myself, and then we'll open up the mics. Now, one of the things I read is DRC voted to support the House Republicans in voting for the pending amnesty. I'm going to call it the amnesty bill. Do you think this amounts to a betrayal of the conservative base of the party?
I didn't catch the first part of it. Were you referring to a resolution passed by the National Committee?
Yes, about supporting the House Republicans in voting for the pending amnesty bill or the immigration bill.
Of course, I was focused on the rules battles and not on the resolutions, but I did have a look at the resolution that was passed. And the resolution said a lot of things that were very supportive of the conservative position. I don't think that that you could characterize this as something that was a defeat for those people who are strongly opposed to an omnibus bill. I think it was pretty darn clear in that resolution that the National Committee is on record as not favoring an omnibus bill and believes that we should consider matters relating to immigration individually. And there was a strong preference in that resolution that first we had to secure the borders. And I think that's a reasonable position for the Republican Party to take, and it's important for the country. We can't have an omnibus bill where there are where first we legalize the status of all the people who are here illegally, and then we see about whether or not we can secure the borders. The borders need to be secured first, and then we'll talk about what else is important and desirable, such things as letting high-quality people who have needed skills get into the country in larger numbers. And that sort of thing. I mean, the Republican Party is in favor of legal immigration, but it is not. But it's clearly on record as being opposed to illegal immigration.
Got it. And I do have some questions coming in from Facebook as well, and we'll bring those in too.
Sure.
But I have one, and we'll bring them. You know, I'll bring those questions on when we get to quarter to the hour. It says, with many of the grassroots conservatives becoming fed up with the lack of what they see as the lack of consideration to their wants and concerns by the RNC, where do you see the Republican Party in the future? More moderate and closer to the Democrats, possibly even irrelevant? And what hope is there for the party?
My prediction is that things are going to go more smoothly than your question would suggest. Since I became active in politics, I turned 21 and registered a Republican in Louisiana, which made me a rare bird in Louisiana back in 1960. There have been several waves of new participants in the Republican Party. All of them, one way or another, committed to conservative principles. And I was part of the Goldwater wave. Large numbers of strongly committed conservatives became active. The idea was to nominate Barry Goldwater to beat the Eastern establishment. And we did. We nominated Goldwater. We lost the election pretty badly. In the early 1970s, the conservative movement, which had been talked about for a long time, suddenly became a lot of of people, a lot of muscle, a lot of expertise. Many conservative organizations were founded through the 70s, and many organizations grew to very large size. I mean, for example, National Right to Work Committee had 25,000 members in 1972. By 1979, they had 1,700,000 members. There was huge growth in conservative organizations of many types. And establishment Republicans were wringing their hands and saying how terrible that was. Then in the late 70s, millions of supporters of traditional values, particularly religious people who were theologically conservative, got active into the party with much hand-wringing and criticism by the media and by the party establishment. And the combination of the conservative movement growth and the enormous numbers of people who could be characterized as the religious right in the 70s, that resulted in Reagan's nomination and election. We've seen more recently, starting in 2009, millions of new people motivated by conservative, classical liberal principles got involved in something that generally described as the Tea Party movement. And there was the weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth by the national media and the party establishment that these people were unsuitable and dangerous. And then more recently, we've had the Ron Paul campaign, which did quite well in a number of states, developed a big grassroots following. And in each of these waves of new people, new principled people coming in, the story was almost the same. People said, these people are ignorant, they are uneducated, they are uncouth, they are dangerous to the Republican Party, they will never be incorporated into the Republican Party, and all the evidence of the past history since the early 1960s indicates that hadn't proved to be true. The principal people came in large numbers, and many people stayed. I'm an example of somebody who was brought in by Goldwater, and I'm still pretty active.
You are.
And similarly, many other people with the conservative movement, the religious right, the Tea Party, and now the Ron Paul Liberty Movement people are still active in the party, and they haven't destroyed the party. As a matter of fact, they've strengthened the party. As a matter of fact, the Republican Party needs every one of those people. Some people drop out, but other people stay in, and in most of the cases, the criticism of these new people is vicious. In most cases, they've tried to say that the principal people now getting involved are somehow racist. It's never been true. Never been true. So I am not greatly worried that the Republican Party cannot accommodate new grassroots people. If enough new grassroots people get involved, then we change the party leadership. Then we nominate people who are committed to principle and defeat people I call content-free Republicans. So I think this is a healthy process, and I understand that there is a human instinct for people who have power to try to use that power to hold on to the power and use that power to accumulate more power for themselves. But if we can prevent further centralization of the Republican Party, if we can keep it open at the bottom so people who newly participate are treated fairly, politely, and cordially, then the party is going to grow as a result of this and not be hurt.
And do you think that the delegates have a shot to change the rules at the next convention, as many minority voices may be vetoed off their delegation?
Well, I would hope that the results of the power grabs at this convention will teach people a lesson. I would hope that the presidential candidates in the 2016 cycle will see the wisdom of having a party that is welcoming and open at the bottom, and the changes can be made. And there's always the possibility that we can make some changes between conventions. I have to say that the office of the chairman of the Republican National Committee is enormously powerful, and frankly, by the nature of the National Party, the chairman has to be powerful. We have 168 members. We meet three times a year, and at our meetings, we have at most a couple of hours of business session, and it's impossible for a 168-person group to micromanage an operation that's raising and spending hundreds of millions of dollars. You've got to have a strong chairmanship operation. But and the chairman of the National Committee controls all the hiring, controls the spending, controls the legal counsel's office, and everybody else who works at the national headquarters or for the national party. It's enormous power there. We've had a great protection through most of my political lifetime that the rules of the party cannot be changed between conventions. And that's been extremely healthy because the chairman of the Republican National Committee has sufficient clout that he can produce a majority, maybe a supermajority, for anything that he wants, or a majority against anything that he opposes. That's the natural course of the arrangements, and I don't think changes in the rules should be within the power of the national chairman. It's a protection. I mean, Thomas Jefferson of Virginia said, put not your trust in men, but bind them down by the chains of the Constitution. And a circumstance where you have a Republican president, the Republican National Committee becomes a wholly owned subsidiary of the White House, and who gets to be national chairman is the choice of the White House, then you would have a case where a president of the United States would have the power to change the rules between conventions. That's a bad idea, too.
Okay, and I know we've running out of time, so I see folks in the switchboard. If you'd like to ask directly Mr. Morton Blackwell any questions, just hit 1 on your number dial. If not, just want to listen in, that's fine as well. So I'll go on to a question that I did get from Facebook. And it says, asking about, let me read here, how about the 60-day nomination period that Priebus is working towards? How is that in Rule 40 make it difficult for any grassroots candidate?
The rules currently allow a decent interval for the nomination process. I understand that the chairman wants to, now that we have increased the penalties for people jumping ahead, and that's another matter I could get into, but I think that the March 1st deadline for all but those four early states is going to be respected by the states, because the penalty is if you jump ahead, you are reduced not by 50% of your delegates, but you are reduced to only 9 delegates. That's a pretty strong curtailment of it. States suffered that penalty and jumped way ahead of March 1st last year in the nomination process. But I think that any further restrictions would be a bad idea. If a state wants to hold its delegate election or its primary relatively late in the season, I think that the state ought to be able to do it. And I am personally opposed, and have made it very clear in communications with all the other members of the National Committee, that I don't think we ought to put any further restrictions on the rights of states and state parties to choose the method and timing of their nomination process. There's a lot of talk and complaint about the fact that there were more than 20 presidential debates in the season last time, and it is true that happened. The process of nomination will already be shorter because we've made sure that it isn't going to start as early last time as it did. I don't think it's a good idea to tell states that we're going to reduce the amount of time after March the 1st that states could make their choices, because then you run into the problem of not giving time for adequate testing and not giving time for a perfectly wonderful candidate to emerge from the pack and generate support and get the nomination.
Right. Yeah, I'd like having the debates. I actually would have liked to see more myself. But speaking of that, I do see there is someone on the line who'd like to ask you a question, and so I'll bring them in. 530, is this Kelly? It is. Thank you very much, Kelly, for calling into the show. It's great hearing from you. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good. I'm glad to hear Mr. Blackwell again.
Okay, great. Well, go ahead. You've got the mic. So any statements or questions you'd like to ask him, go ahead.
Well, being you're on the Rules Committee, RNC, this is something I'd like to see, and I'm just curious about the possibility of this even happening. A in-house rule by the Republicans that to essentially run for any position within the RNC, but also as a political position, pass a constitutional exam in-house. And it could be a very easy exam. What's the probability of that being introduced and possibly passing?
Well, I've never heard such a thing suggested. It might produce interesting results. One important thing is that the Republican National Committee, thank goodness, does not have any authority over any elections other than the presidential election, and that primarily over the presidential nomination. The Republican National Committee has no ability whatsoever to tell a state party what it does with respect to the nomination process of governors or senators or congressmen or local officials. It is an interesting fact that political parties in the United States are very different in structure from political parties in any other country that I know about, and I know about a lot of different countries. In most countries, the political party is completely unitary, and if you control the national party, you pretty well can control what goes on in the local parties. You can pretty well determine who gets the nominations of the party. In countries with proportional representation of elected officials, the party puts together a list of candidates, and if your party wins a popular vote that entitles you to have 12 members of the national parliament, then the top 12 people on your list are are all elected, and anybody 13 down on your list isn't elected. The parties have immense power. A lot of people believe that the Republican National Committee runs the Republican Party in the United States, and that is not true. It has limited power, and it primarily has to do with the presidential nomination process. And they do important things in general elections, can do things that other parties can't. But there are many other very significant Republican organizations which are not controlled by the Republican National Committee. The Republican National Congressional Committee works to elect members of the U.S. House, Republican a National Senatorial Committee, focuses on electing U.S. senators. The Republican Governors Association focuses on trying to elect governors. The party auxiliaries are completely independent. The Women's Federation is independent. The Young Republicans are independent. College Republicans are independent. The state parties are independent. If the Republican National Committee tried to tell a state party that they had to spend money for something, or that they had to pass some internal rule within the states, except as it relates to the presidential nomination process, people would laugh at them. You don't have the power to do that. And if the national party tried to do that, there would be great outrage. So
okay.
A very different thing. And I wasn't sure exactly what you were proposing in terms of a test. We've had a discussion about qualifications for national officers. It was not entirely clear in the rules. In practice, it was clear that you could elect a chairman of the National Committee who wasn't a member of the RNC, and we'd been doing that for years, but the point was raised that wasn't entirely clear that you could do that, so the rules were changed, and now the National Committee can elect somebody chairman who is not, at the time of election, a member of the National Committee.
Okay. Yeah, because long story, but yes, there are different groups and different groups, state, congressional committees, et cetera, et cetera. If this is something I wanted to see, I'm here in California, here on the left coast, and if it's something I wanted to see, I would have to probably work within the party or the local or any other type of these subgroups, because I'd like to see it happen.
If you want to change the rules of the Republican Party, you need to go to the members of your state of the National Committee. Your National Committee man is Sean Steele. I've known him for decades. He was earlier state party chairman, and he is California's representative on the Standing Committee on Rules. And so an appropriate thing for you to do would talk to him and see if he could not propose whatever change that you're interested in.
Oh, yeah, I talked with my county Republican leader, Donald Schweitzer, and him and I hit it off, and we're, you know, love the Constitution. And yeah, I might kind of try through that, because, you know, in the bigger picture, I'm an engineer. I applied at a local manufacturing, and I had to take a math test. Okay, so if a doctor goes for an interview and, do you know about medicine? And if he says, well, the medicine's a good idea, I'm like, no, what do you know about medicine? I've interviewed people running for candidacy, be it, you know, at the local tea parties. They'd come and visit, be it Democrats or Independents or Republicans, and I would always ask them, what's Article 9 and 10 of the Bill of Rights? And they don't know it, but they would first start out with, well, the Constitution is a really good idea. So that's not what I'm asking. I'm asking if you know it, you know the specific things. A doctor would never get a job. Knowing the Constitution is like a job interview. It's the supreme law of the land to which they write bills from. And I would really like to see.
Oh no! There you go. Go ahead.
Yeah,
okay. Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, I would just like to see some type of job entrance exam for the political office when you're writing laws for the Constitution. It's just kind of, in my mind, it's just kind of common sense, and I don't know how to accomplish this.
Well, I think the only thing that the Republican National Committee might have to do with that would be to set up some kind of criteria for candidates for election. But let me give you two relevant facts. Number one, if there's a Republican president, he has the power to pass the word to the Republican National Committee, I want so-and-so to be national chairman, and that person is going to be elected. The other thing is that if there is not a Republican president in the White House, then there are lots of people who want to be Republican national chairman. And you'll wind up with five or six or seven candidates who will have to run an active campaign and run it in a lot of different venues. And if somebody were abysmally ignorant about the U.S. Constitution, it would be easy enough to expose that person, which would hurt that person's candidacy.
And at that, Kelly, I do have to chime in here and say thank you very much for giving a call. And, of course, you're Michael Stope, and I do have other folks who'd like to chime in, but I do know it is at the top of the hour. And I did promise Morton that, you know, we'd give him an hour, and if he'd have to go at 11, you know, we'd appreciate all the time that he gave us. Now, I do have perhaps one more person in here that maybe we could squeeze in for a question.
Okay.
If not,
I'll take your next question, and then we'll ring off. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. And this is 559. Your mic is open, and I do see real quick, I see James on the line and Brian. We'll be opening up your mic soon to talk about the overpasses and the events there and the updates. But first, 559, quick question do you have for Mr. Morton Blackwell?
Me?
Yeah, 559.
Oh, this is Brian, man.
Oh, Brian? Okay, I'm sorry. Well,
while I'm on, I do have a question for Morton Blackwell.
Oh, go ahead, and then 608, go ahead.
Mr. Blackwell, sir, I thought we were going to be on for a couple minutes together, and I did a little Google search on you, and I ran across the fact that you came up with the Reagan Youth Campaign, and
yeah,
how did that come to mind?
How did it happen?
But yeah, how did that come about, the Reagan Youth Campaign?
Okay, I got active at the Goldwater Campaign. Started a college Republican club at LSU in 1962, became college Republican state chairman, built a tiny federation into a strong federation. 1965, I was given the job of executive director of the College Republican National Organization, had that job off and on 5.5 years, started training programs to train people to organize large numbers of college students, had great success at it. And built up a reputation. And in 1980, when Bill Casey became the campaign manager for Ronald Reagan after the New Hampshire primary, Bill Casey, whom I knew slightly, called me up and he said, "Morton, everybody tells me that you'd be the best person to run the national youth effort for Reagan. Would you be interested?" And my answer was absolutely. So that's how I was put in charge of the Reagan Youth Effort of 1980, and it was highly successful.
Yeah, it really was. And like when I saw the way that Obama ran his first campaign, and I was like, oh my goodness, like he's going way too technological. There are too many youth involved with this. Like, this guy's going to get elected. He's doing this right. Like, and it was just like, whoa, like somebody's actually appealing to the youth in their campaign. Like, I'm not an Obama supporter at all, but he definitely did very, like, similar, like, modern youth techniques, if you will.
Yeah, well,
in his first campaign.
There is going to be, in this school year, a very rapid decline in Obama's popularity with young people, because this Obamacare is hitting young people harder than anybody else. Enormous increases in the cost of insuring young people, and any smart candidate can get a lot of youth support now by revealing to people just exactly how much more costly insurance is going to be, and they're going to have to pay it. And it's the group that's hardest hit, and deliberately so, intentionally, it's the young people.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you very much for answering my question.
You're welcome.
And real quick, I am going to open up your mic real quick, 608, because I said I accidentally pushed the wrong button, to be honest. And then, but I appreciate, Brian, you also getting the chance to ask that question. So 608, welcome to the show. I know Morton's got to get going soon. So were you calling about the overpasses for this evening or about the RNC meeting?
The RNC, this is Arlen of Gulag Bound and the as yet nascent sovereignty campaign. Good evening, Robert. And Mr. Blackwell, I have to say Mr. Blackwell because you are like, you're under a demigod, but you are so important to the cause that we have to preserve this country. I was wondering about the ways to fix the power grab, and I was wondering if there was any landmark that we should be looking to in the process. I'm kind of not clear on that. Does it have to wait until 2016, or are there things that can be done right away or sometime in between where these state committees can be of influence or in one way or another that the power grab can be fixed, or and maybe things even be more opened up to true Republicanism?
Well, between now and September of 2014, this new Rule 12, which I said at the time on the floor of the Convention Rules Committee was the worst proposal I had ever heard, and I've been to all the meetings of the Convention Rules Committee starting in 1972, the very worst. But the RNC is right to change the rules in this election cycle, ends under Rule 12 in September 2014. I intend to be active at every member of the meeting of the Republican National Committee. Others I know are going to be active. There will be proposals and record votes every time the RNC meets, and I'm going to be communicating what I think ought to be done to everybody and people who want to influence the votes of their state's three members are free to do so.
Thank you very much. If I have one more minute, I'd like to follow up maybe in another way with you, Morton. But is it true that on the way to the convention in August of last year to the decisive vote on amendments that the Virginia delegation was nearly all taken on a bus ride and prevented from getting to the amendment vote on time?
Well, the story spread instantly because I was leading the fight throughout the whole process against the Ginsburg power grabs. We finished our business in the week before the convention, and there was scheduled to be a pro forma meeting of the Convention Rules Committee, where ordinarily we would just adopt, because the committee becomes the permanent committee once the convention takes in. And so the routine is to adopt what the temporary committee, which was the committee that did all the work, did. So ordinarily there weren't going to be any changes made. The power grabs were all over. It was not the decisive meeting. One of the power grabs was so awful that they were going to have a minority report because they wanted to give presidential candidates the right to remove delegates, duly elected delegates, and that was a step too far, and they so that was taken out. It was not the decisive meeting at all, but the truth is, it had been very hot politically, and lots of thunder and lightning and strong presentations the previous week. And so the Virginia delegation was 29 miles away in Clearwater Beach, and we were with the same hotel with the Rhode Island delegation, and we got onto the bus that was over 2 hours late, and we went into the city, and the bus driver couldn't find it. It was turned around by policemen, et cetera, and people in the final pro forma meeting were saying, "Where's Morton? Where's Morton?" Well, Morton was available by cell phone, and I told people what was happening, and people began to believe that it was some conspiracy to keep me out of that meeting. I never believed that for a minute. I never think you should attribute to conspiracy what sheer incompetence can adequately explain. And the whole bus system was screwed up that first day of the convention. Not only getting there, but coming back. Some delegates didn't get back to their hotels on their buses until 3 o'clock. It was just a disaster. And a very funny thing happened last week in Boston. The RNC made a couple of trips by bus away from the hotel. One of them was a trip to Fenway Park. And after the Fenway Park event, I piled onto the bus, and I was with some Rhode Island people. And we were talking and having a good time. And there was nothing else scheduled in the evening that we had to get to. Suddenly, one of my friends came up to me and said, "You will not believe this, but we have been traveling 25 miles in the wrong direction, away from the hotel." And the Rhode Island people said that means it'll be an hour later that we expected to get back to the hotel. And one of them suggested that the Virginia delegates and Rhode Island delegates are somehow being victimized. But I don't think that there was any plot to keep me from getting to that last session. I was very unhappy that I was not there. I finally ran when the bus finally got in, and I was 5 minutes after the committee had adjourned. But there was not a single thing that was possible to do for the good at that meeting. I mean, I could have repeated some of the reasons why I thought what had happened was bad, but it wasn't going to be reversed. So it's an interesting story, and now compounded by an analogous problem in Boston last
right.
week.
I don't know. You just string too many things together. No, kidding. But people are like, "Well, wait a minute." So if there's anything else you'd like to add, Morton?
No, I think we better ring off. I was pleased to be with you, help you on some other occasion, let me know.
I appreciate it, and I appreciate you coming on and staying more time than you said allotted, and I'm sure everyone, especially those who got their last-minute questions, and really appreciate it. I just want to open up to if there's any last things you want to chime in on, but...
We've got to open the party in the bottom if we're going to win for conservative principles, and we got to defeat content-free Republicans who are motivated not by conservative principles. That's my final word. Thank you all. Bye bye.
Take care and have a good night. Thank you very much. Really appreciate it. Okay, folks, and that was Morton Blackwell. Well, I hope everyone enjoyed the time he was able to stay on the show. And so at this time, I will open up the mic to Mr. James Nabors, who began the overpasses for Obama's impeachment. Sorry about the delay, folks, but I did want to be able to get a couple questions in that some folks had for Mr. Blackwell. It's an honor to have him onto the show, and I really appreciate him staying on as long as he did. So thank you very much, Mr. Nabors, for coming on. How are you?
Oh, I'm doing great. How are you doing tonight?
Well, I'm doing really well. Real happy that we're able to hear from Mr. Blackwell and all the others who were able to call in to the show to listen in on that. So what I'd like to do is get a little update on how the August 6th overpasses for Obama's impeachment went, and then I do have your mic open still, Brian, for your story of what happened to you over there in California. And we'll go over from there, and then later on we can still bring some more discussion about the RNC meeting. We do have about 45 minutes left of live time, but those who are familiar with the show know that we many times go to extended versions, which gives us an extra 59 minutes. So we do have plenty of time to get everything in tonight. So, as I like to say, Mr. Nabors, the mic is yours.
Well, the 6th went over very well. It was our initial rollout of the Patriot Wave. We had events in all 50 states. Mostly, most of the states had multiple metro areas that covered that. And then just 11 days after that, on the 17th, we had the second Patriot Wave, and that went over, you know, just even better. It went over even better. We had probably three times the attendance on the 17th that we did on the 6th. And it, I mean, just really, by the time the second one rolled around, the media was aware. We've gotten attention out all across the nation. The movement has since grown to over 42,000 people. And it's just, I mean, it's just, it continues to grow and accelerate. And I mean, our people are very, very psyched up. You know, we did have three unfortunate arrests, Brian being one of them. And then on the 17th, Mark Messmer and, who lives in St. Charles, Missouri, and Dwayne Weed of Bridgeton, Missouri, were also arrested. And they were held for 24 hours in a holding cell in Missouri. And apparently we've got a bit of a generational gap between the police understanding the rights of protesters. Unfortunately, Brian and Dwayne and Mark have had to pay the consequences of the ignorance of law enforcement, you know, the fact that we have the First Amendment, and that the Supreme Court clearly states we have a right to be on sidewalks, which is where all three arrests occurred. And in, you know, in 1939, the Supreme Court made a very clear decision that sidewalks in a public access way are free speech zones, and that the police can't interfere with that, but they appear to have forgotten that. And Brian has, you know, unfortunately been a victim of arrest and unfortunately appears to have been police assault.
Brian?
As well as Mark and Dwayne. I mean, if people were looking, and wondering when a police state was going to arrive, it's 2013 and that police state has arrived.
And with that, Brian, we'll open up. Well, your mic is open, but we'll bring the mic over to you and tell us your story. What happened over there?
Well, it was Patriot Wave, and we were super stoked. We were trying out a new overpass for like the first official time, and that was Sean 41 in Fresno. And me and a couple others had gone there and just like done some recon, seen if it was good, held some signs, checked the response. And so then it was a go for Tuesday. And then I took off for a little bit to get some water and stuff with my girlfriend. And then as I was walking back, was when I saw like two or three CHP cars and a Caltrans truck. And so I just, I pull out my phone and start recording, which is, you know, what you should do. And like right as I get there, one of the cops is like, "You smell like weed." And I just knew that somebody was looking for a confrontation, you know? And after that, like, they come over, like, to the actual group, and we try to give them the, like, the paperwork with all of, like, all of the traffic rules and, you know, the violations that we weren't breaking. Like, we're not encroaching. Like, all this crazy list of rules that, you know, they were trying to say we were breaking. We had it all, you know, firmly printed, the entire regulation, in, like, these big paragraphs on orange papers. It was easy to read. And they wouldn't even look at it. They're like, we already saw that last week, you know, we don't need to see that this week. And then the Caltrans guy made, like, a stealth mission around the corner to try and get the unguarded banners that were just, like, there to get the overpasses that was going north. And when I saw that, I went over there to, like, videotape him and, you know, maybe talk him out of it. And I jumped up on the overpass in front of the American flag, and I was, like, videotaping. And then I figured, well, if that cop decides to come and, like, pull me off this overpass, I could probably get hurt. So I hopped down. I'm still talking to the Caltrans guy and, like, asking him not to cut our stuff down. And then at this time, the cop runs up on me. And I'm not a big dude at all. I'm, like, 145, 150 pounds. And he was, like, a good, you know, 240, just, like, a beefy stormtrooper for the government. And he was, like, chest bumping me back. And I was just, like, trying to stand my ground and, like, take little steps and, like, comply. And, like, after about, like, the third chest bump, I'm just, like, don't push me. And, like, as I'm saying that, he just, like, reels back and shoves me on the ground.
Hmm.
And so I lay on the ground for a little bit, and then, like, I make a joke at the cop running up, like, "Hey, bro, don't tase me. I got a bad ticker." And then I hop up, and as I'm getting up, I'm like, I'm just going to file a complaint. And, like, right after I said that, the cop who wasn't really involved, he was just, like, running up to see what was going on, he arrests me. And it didn't make any sense. He was like, come here, you know, you're under arrest. And I'm just like, for what? And long story short, they frisk me real quick, throw me in the back of a cop car, take me down to CHP, and I just, like, hang out for 2 hours. Then they take me to the jail, where I hang out for, like, another hour, and they release me to the street. It was like, they just, like, detained me for, you know, 3-4 hours, and then gave me a misdemeanor obstruction of justice, and a misdemeanor failing to obey a lawful order. And they just let me right back on the street, like, 3-4 hours later. Here you go, man. No fines, no nothing, no signatures needed. It's almost like a long point of, like, my back.
Well, your mic's breaking up there, or phone connection's breaking up there really bad, Brian.
Oh, it is?
There we go. That sounds a lot better. You're breaking up there bad.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Nick, go ahead.
But,
the last couple of sentences, if you could repeat, because we may have missed those. Go ahead.
So, like I said, they took me to the CHP, and then I sat there for a couple hours, and then they took me to the jail. They booked me into a holding cell, and not to be like I was scared or anything. But, like, every dude I was in there with was just, like, covered in tattoos. One guy wasn't even wearing a shirt. He was arrested without his shirt on. And I was laughing, like, at, like, the, like, and I start talking to these guys, right? And they're just normal dudes. Like, one got dragged out of his house just, and he couldn't really tell me why. He was just like, "I don't know, man. I was just dragged out of my house today." And he was, you know, and so they released me a few hours later, and it was like they kidnapped me. And then just let me go. I wasn't really sure what to make of the whole situation after I was done. But I knew that I'd been assaulted by the people who were supposed to protect me, and I knew that I wasn't right. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when you watch, you served too as well, didn't you?
I did serve, yes.
Well, yeah, so I want to talk about, you know, a police state. Did they ever... And I said, what were the charges against you again? And
obstruction
what's the,
of justice.
The status of that right now?
I have to go to my first court date on the next month, on the 28th. Maybe we can get some overpass people there to like protest the court date. But
that's an idea.
Maybe we can do that for Mark and Dwayne too. But they give me a court date for next month. But I don't know how they have charges that can stick. Like, the video proves that I haven't done anything. There's multiple angles. And I don't know how they can make charges stick. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. And do you have a lawyer for when you go?
I don't have a lawyer for when I go. I haven't been assigned a public defender or anything for this case. So I'm not exactly, like, I'm kind of struggling with the law side of this.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was unaware of that, Brian. I was under the impression you were getting a little bit of help out there, and I'll do some looking into that and see what we can get found for you.
Okay.
You know, so I'll see what we can do on this end with this end for you. If you would go ahead and send me the dates of whenever you're due in court, and I'll talk to the people out there in Fresno and see if we can't get something. And I don't see why we wouldn't. Get something arranged, you know, in support for you outside the courtroom. And I'm not sure what they allow inside the courtroom, but, you know, maybe we could get some people in the courtroom in support of you as well. Certainly some eyewitnesses would be a bonus. And I would hope they would allow the video footage in your defense. And we'll, you know, but we'll see what we can do about getting you some legal representation. I was under the impression that was already taken care of. So my apologies for not being more appraised of that situation.
No problem.
Brian, this is Kelly. You're kind of guest panelist guy. Anyway, two nights ago I talked to an attorney. Her name is Miss Wilson. She lives out of San Francisco.
Okay.
And she has got a lot of fire behind her. She has got a 90% success rate on civil lawsuits like your situation. If you remember many years ago, in Southern Cal, when they raided the milk police. The milk police came in and shut down a dairy co-op. She's on that case. And ironic, but she called me for some help a couple nights ago. But I don't know if her caseload can handle it, but she is a real tiger. She loves the Constitution. I'll hopefully talk to her in the next week or so and try to see what we can do. I would still encourage Mr. Neighbors to keep looking for representation because this lady, Ms. Wilson, might be too busy. And then I wanted to throw something out. Robert knows what I'll be doing, but I want to go ahead and let you guys finish your story, and then I want to propose another solution to what they did to you.
Okay.
Yeah, go ahead, Brian. But first, Kelly, yeah, just let's get some information together, and you and I will keep in touch, and we'll keep in touch with Brian. About getting some contact information so you guys can work on that. And you guys can just email me and then I can share the information, the contact information, so you guys can get on that. So go ahead, Brian.
Okay. That's really appreciative. That's kind of the end of the story until, like, a few days later I started getting harassing messages from some people, like, calling me, like, a liar and, you know, saying that I – one even, like, said that I tried to – like, someone told me they tried – I assaulted the cop. Like, just, you know, ridiculous stuff that people say when incidents like this happen. But, so, I mean, other than that, like, it's been pretty peaceful at our continued protests. We hit the same overpass that I was arrested on every Saturday from 8 to 11. And the past two protests, we haven't, like, no police, no Caltrans. They don't even look at us, like, so I think we scared them.
Well, now don't tempt them, Brian. You don't want to give them another reason to come back out. But
that's true.
Right.
But
and Arlen points out in the chat. He said he, you know, when you go to the court, the officers might not even show up. You know.
Oh yeah.
So, well, I wouldn't count on that, but I'd count on having a strong defense.
Oh, definitely. I think I've got my hand on every scrap of paper, you know, audio footage from that day. So as soon as I have like an actual like lawyer that I'm sitting down with and talking to, I'll be able to give all that over to him and let him make the assessment of what's going on.
And would you like to chime in on any of that, James?
Well, I think it's really just a shame that in 2013 that our civil rights have degraded so far that that law enforcement and it appears to be so far just be limited to the highway patrol that believe they can run around like Judge Dredd, that they are the law, and no matter what they say, whether they can cite a law or not, that they simply have the power of arrest, and no matter what they say, whether it's right or wrong, and that's the way it's going to be. I think that they have forgotten that they're actually there as well as our congressmen, you know, to serve us. And we're not there at their beck and call. We're certainly not their slaves, and we aren't answerable to every one of their whims. They may not like the message that we carry, but the fact of the matter is the Supreme Court has clearly stated that we have the right to deliver that message, whether it be distasteful, whether it be politically incorrect, whether it be in opposition of a politician that they adore. You know, the fact of the matter is we have a right as Americans to deliver that message if we see fit. And this Judge Dreddian mentality that these highway patrol out in Missouri and in Oklahoma and in California and in a few other states where they've forbidden them to protest on overpasses, even though they had sidewalks, which the Supreme Court clearly stated are free speech zones, it's just sad that they think that they can enforce a law that's non-existent, that their word is the law. And
Mr. Neighbors, I want to ask you because I'm going to write this court case down. There's another situation the same as far as free speech is basically gone. What's the court case?
Let me pull that up for you real quick. It's a versus CIO. It's Hague versus CIO was the Supreme Court decision. It was found back in 1939, and the ACLU uses it in their right to protest references. If you were to go to ACLU.org and look up rights to protest, and that decision's never been overturned. It still stands.
Can you say that one again? Which one?
Hague versus CIO.
Hayden?
Hague, H-A-G-U-E.
Okay, H-A-G-U-E versus C-I-O. There's an American right now in exile in Israel. His name is Julian Hyken. He was passing out jury nullification flyers. Can't remember what town on the East Coast. And nothing specific about any case. He's handing them out. And then they come and arrest him. And this is ironic about jury nullification. Well, I want to get in front of a jury. Why? Well, what's the evidence of what he was doing wrong? Oh, look, it's a flyer that says I can say this law is bogus. I'm not voting this guy guilty for passing out these flyers. They can't get the evidence. So anyway, what they have to do to stop people from passing out jury nullification flyers, they have gone to the free speech doesn't apply on this public sidewalk. So they made up a bunch of stuff and said, your free speech right does not apply on this sidewalk in front of a federal building. And they arrested him, and they put him through hell. He's still in trial, but he fled to Israel. They're doing the same thinking thing. That's what I'm telling you.
Well, back to what I was saying earlier, is if you wanted to know when America was going to become a police state, well, 2013, it has become a police state. And if we, the people, don't stand up and demand our constitutional rights back, and we don't do it now, and we don't do it in numbers, it will only get worse until we simply have none. I mean, you know, when Obamacare kicks in, they have a right to come into your house without a warrant and search your house with no warrant just because they get a hankering to come dig through your house. And And if we want America to continue in this direction, then we can just continue to be silent, because silence is consent. But if this is not the direction that you want America to go in, to go toward, where you have no right to free speech, where you no longer have a right to privacy in your own home, then just simply sit by and do nothing. But if you feel like, if you believe that America is supposed to be the land of the free, that our founding fathers' sacrifices should not go in vain, then you can't just sit around any longer. You simply cannot. You can't make excuses. You've got to get out and speak out. And people like Brian and Mark and Dwayne, they're paying the price right now. And I had to flee to Israel. They're paying the price right now.
Oh, absolutely.
And those freedoms being stomped on it.
Absolutely.
How many more arrests have to occur before?
I got a question for you. Because I heard that there was another one in Eureka, similar to what Brian went through, Eureka, California.
Am I on?
Real quick, Brian, I do have someone else on the line who'd like to chime in. So what we'll do is we'll have Brian chime in on it, and then answer the question about the other city there in California, and then we'll be opening up Constantine's mic. So go ahead, Brian.
So I did when I saw that pop up on the California overpasses page, I definitely read the article and then double checked on it. And if what I'm reading is true, I'm not 100% here. It's a slam piece, and it's being used to deter people from heading to the overpasses, because people are getting arrested.
Also, it did not happen in Eureka? Because I was pretty shocked when I read that.
That's what I'm reading right now. I'm not sure if it's a real thing or not, but it appears to be just like a slam piece that some unreliable journal list or news source put out, and it's not the first time that they've done this either, if what I'm reading is true. And they're just put a slam piece to scare people from coming to the overpasses.
Well, and that was our understanding as well, but that was actually an old, the arrest footage was actually an old old photograph from an anti-war protest back when Bush was in office, and that, everything that we have been able to dig up on that Eureka, those Eureka arrests, is that it's completely false. Exactly like you said, it's nothing more than an attempt to intimidate people from protesting, and we have not been able to find anything. There certainly were no people that were in overpasses that were arrested in Eureka, none at all.
Okay.
Eureka is a very liberal place. It's ocean. It's near the ocean, and there might, of course, be Tea Partiers there, but it is very liberal, so it might have been a scam.
Well, it looks like we got that answer there, hopefully to your satisfaction there, Kelly, and as I said, I will keep all the mics open, and speaking of that, I will like to take this time to open up and welcome Constantine to the show. Thank you very much. How are you?
Oh, just making the natives restless as usual. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you for coming to the show.
What's on your mind? I've listened to your show before, but I just thought I would chime in and give some advice, seeing as I can give a little bit of perspective on this, being an activist myself. I would just say, and this isn't against lawyers in particularly, but when you're appointed an attorney, The problem is, certainly there's some lawyers that will do everything they can and break their backs, to defend you. But, keep in mind that these are officers of the court, and they really don't work for you. And that they're going to get paid no matter how good or bad of a job that they do. It's just the reality of the court-appointed system, And you need to be careful, because when you have someone appointed for you, you give it the right to be able to speak to the judge directly for yourself, and they basically can say whatever they want, which is good if he's a good attorney, or even if they're a good or bad attorney. If they just choose not to sit there and buck the system, they can pretty much do that. You know, I mean, you can make a complaint to the Bar Association later or something like that, but, you know, in the meanwhile, it's your tail that's, you know, not going to get good representation. So I'm just saying, it's not always the case, but, you know, you need to be careful, and, you know, you need to, you know, carefully consider, you know, having someone appointed to you, basically. Oh. What, you know.
No, I don't have to cut you off, but I get exactly what you're saying. In my youth, I was in front of the court before, and I was like, they brought me a good plea, and it, you know, it seemed like it was good. I got to stay in the Army, and so I just took it immediately without thinking about it, because it saved my job in the Army, and I, you know, put me on probation, but that was it. You know, done nothing else. So I was like, cool, I can take that, you know. But looking back, like if I had actually gone to court and spoke for myself and put up a fight, I probably wouldn't have a record, you know.
Well, you know, like I said, generally speaking, you know, attorneys that are officers of the court and that sign up for the appointment system usually are not going to sit there and fight against law enforcement or fight against the judicial system, you know, very much, if at all. You know, and, you know, to give you a point of reference, like, what, how the hell do I know what I'm talking about? Well, I mean, you know, my father was an activist, and so was I, and I've never really been in trouble because, you know, I did anything wrong, but, you know, I mean, we did protest, and here in Texas, basically, I ran for a municipal spot on our city council, and I exposed and did a story about how our mayor was using his position to basically extort about $250 million on a lake project he had here that it wasn't actually going to cost, because the company he worked for owned the land that they were selling to the city. And so when I exposed that, it made a lot of people mad, and they got a Texas Ranger involved and didn't say, we think he did this. They told him to, quote unquote, find a charge. And, and they really couldn't find anything that was, you know, I mean, in the Ranger, you know, and I was brought before the grand jury five times before I was indicted, you know, because the Ranger himself said, there's no case here. This is just a political maneuvering. They just don't want this kid running again, you know. Well, I mean, kid, I'm 40 now, but, you know. And so what ended up happening is, so I, of course, at this time, you know, I'd been harassed, and they'd come up to my work because I'd made the wrong people mad and got me fired three times in a row. And, you know, of course, I have no rights. You know, I mean, I complained to the judge, and they just said, well, there's nothing against in the law for a police officer coming up there and telling your employer what you're being accused of. You know,
wow.
So, but I got a point now. But this is the great part about it. The attorney that I got appointed was actually a pretty good attorney. The only problem is he was a best friend and worked in the same office with the person I ran against. He wouldn't even speak to my witnesses, you know, before the trial. Wouldn't call them on the phone, much less call them.
Yeah.
Didn't even listen to my whole story. And just told me what a nice guy his friend was. And said,
well,
you're either going to take this deferred adjudication plea, or you're going to end up in jail, because I'm just simply not going to offend you, because what you did by running against him was horrible. And I had no rights. I tried to talk to the judge, and the judge said, I can't talk to you. It's like, well, yeah, but my attorney is like, well, you have to take that up with the state bar. But the problem is the lawyer used my right to a speedy trial to circumvent my right to contest his appointment, because to be able to ask for a new lawyer, the lawyer in Texas has to bring up the petition. I don't have a right to speak before the judge.
Yeah.
So I either had the choice of either pleading no contest, deferred adjudication, be on probation for 5 years because I ran for public office and lost, or face going to prison for 5 years. So, you know.
Good grief.
You know, I'm just saying, I kind of know what it's like to be railroaded in because people abuse their power.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
I mean, there's no punchline here. I mean, I'm serious. You know, I called every organization I could think of, and everybody said, told the same thing. Well, one of the problems is you're white. You know, I mean, if this, there's a number of minority groups that would help me, you know. The ACLU wouldn't come in down there because, you know, in Texas, this particular district attorney's had like several dozen complaints against him. But here in Texas, pretty much you can prosecute or not prosecute what you want. It's not really an ethical question in Texas. I mean, the DA can sit there. It's like, example, last year somebody shot, there was an ice day, icing on the road, and this guy ran into somebody else, and he just got mad. It wasn't the guy in front of his fault. It was his fault, you know. And so he walked out, and the guy got out of his car, and, you know, thought he wasn't mad or yelling or anything. He was just going to exchange his information in front of 14 witnesses and shot him in the head and killed him dead.
Oh, my God.
And the guy, you know, he waited for the cops to come. Of course, the guy that shot the other person, whose family is wealthy here in Abilene, mm-hmm. and they let him go. Didn't even arrest him.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, shot the guy in the head dead in front of a dozen witnesses. The thing is, what I'm saying is I'm not a conspiracy theorist. You know, I mean, the thing is there's good and bad people everywhere. But, you know, well, Texas has kind of an old boy system, though. And I'm just saying that states, especially in smaller towns, and when you're dealing with municipal stuff and when you're dealing with, like, possibly the Highway Patrol as well, you need to keep taking consideration that the majority of these people are friends. And the thing is ultimately their duty and their employer is the court, not you. And I'm not saying that your lawyer won't be excellent, do a perfect job, but what I am saying is when you agree to have some, instead of paying to get a lawyer privately and having someone paid for you to represent you, you give up any right that you did have to defend yourself. And it's just, well, you just hope God he chooses to, but if he doesn't, he still gets paid the same amount of money, whether he wins or loses or screws you.
Yeah, wow. That's true.
You know, and I'm not a negative person at all. I'm not being ugly. I love my country. And I would do everything I did again because, you know what, I saved the taxpayers here in this county about $250 million. But, you know, I would also say that when you fight against injustice, because I'm telling you from this personalist perspective, don't be surprised when they do something unethical to stop you.
Oh, yeah.
Well, you know, if you're fighting a lack of ethics, don't be surprised when they use a lack of ethics to prosecute you. But be careful. I speak from personal experience.
And real quick, folks.
That's it. I've shot my wad. Thanks.
No, that's okay. We can continue on. I just want to let the listeners know, who are listening live, that there's only about 13 minutes of the live version, and we may go into, at least for a little while, to the extended version. So if you'd like to listen to the extended version, please call in at area code 347-945-7428. And if you'd like to chime in, just push the 1 on your number dial, or let me know in chat or on Facebook that you'd like to chime in. And so we'll just go to the extended edition of that. Again, that's let me see my info number. It's 347-945-7428. So let's see the extended version, of course. If you decide to just call us after the live version, you're always welcome to go to the archive, which will be available immediately after the show. And for those who are not going to go to the extended version, please, after the show, just take a little time to visit the Bard's Logic Political Talk website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. And one of the pages I'd really like to put out there is the gift page, where I have some links to some great organizations, such as the Angel Heart Farm, who I interviewed a few weeks ago. And they are a nonprofit organization that uses equine-assisted therapy for children and their families facing a chronic or life-threatening illness. It's just a great organization that helps kids who have those kind of illnesses, you know, forget about their hardships for a while at this farm that they can visit anytime they like. So definitely check that out, and there's links there on the website for people to go to. And so what I'll do now is I'll go back to the mic. I do see some other folks who have called in. So if you would like to chime in, just push the, as I said, the 1 on your number dial. And we haven't heard from James for a little bit. So, James, if you'd like to chime in on anything that you've heard, go ahead. Mic's yours.
Well, in regards to the public pretenders that call themselves public defenders, you know, you have to be a little wary of any attorney that's on the same payroll as the district attorney. Their job is simply to get a paycheck. It's not as honorable as it once was, to where, you know, they were legitimately trying to get people free. The fact is if the public defenders get too many people found innocent, they're replaced with less competent people. And so we're going to have to try to find you an actual attorney. You know, I mean, if in a last resort you have to use one of those, you know, an officer of the court, I would try to defend yourself as much as possible instead of allowing them to. I've seen far too many people get very lengthy prison sentences here in Oklahoma that use public defender, you know, systems, and it's really become a travesty of the justice system. So, you know, Brian, you know, definitely we're gonna put some effort into getting you real representation. I would definitely put your videos on a DVD so they could be viewed by the court. I would start with the number 3 video that of yours, you know, from your perspective, and let them view that if they want to go back and watch the rest of them in court. But I mean, really, the one from your perspective where you're shoved to the ground, I think is the most critical of the evidence of all of it. And, you know, we just simply have to stand up for our rights now. I mean, our nation is crumbling in every aspect. You know, the fact that we're over $17 trillion in debt to, you know, primarily the Chinese government. Earlier this year, the Chinese, you know, propaganda newspaper was calling for the disarmament of the American public. And, you know, one has to wonder if there's not a reason behind that. I mean, after all, we do owe them an incredible amount of money. And perhaps they'd like to come over and collect it. You know, I mean, I don't know. It seems a little coincidental that the Chinese would want us disarmed at the same time Dianne Feinstein, Obama, and Nancy Pelosi and Harry Reid are, you know, dancing around the bonfire trying to get us all disarmed at the same time we've run up $17 trillion in debt. I mean, this country is crumbling, and if we don't take it back, you know, we're headed for some very, very dark times. And,
think about,
you know, unfortunately, the American public has become complacent, and we have got to wake them up. That's our duty, and I commend you for doing your duty so, you know, so diligently that unfortunately it led to your arrest. But it, you know, that was the beginning of getting people's attention. You really started waking people up to watching for videos for overpasses, and you were the icebreaker for the public. The video of the arrest in St. Charles, Missouri has been viewed so many times that it's just simply amazing. I mean, it's become the definition of viral, and it was your false arrest and assault by the California Highway Patrol that broke the ice for that. And I'm sorry it had to be you, but in the same instance, I thank you for standing up for your rights, and we've got to get more people out there to do that.
Oh, go ahead.
It's getting very bad out there. The economy is not going to get any better as long as we've got these people leading it, and we've got to get Obama removed from office before the economy collapses, or he may never leave office.
And real
Hopefully.
Quick, folks, real quick, Brian, I'm looking at the chat, and I see some folks from Conservative Nation Radio in the chat. Thank you very much for coming to the show. Bart's Logic Political Talk. I also want to tell the folks that they are part of the Patriot Journalist Network, so is Bart's Logic Political Talk, and you can find the Patriot Journalist Network by going to www.patriotjournalist.com. Check it out. It's a great Twitter team, great website for patriots to get together. Right now it's reaching 4,825,000 plus Twitter timelines, which about 1,500 members of Conservative Voices. So, again, that's thepatriotjournalist.com. So welcome very much to listening to the show, Conservative Nation Radio. So go ahead. I'll bring the mic back to you, Brian, when you're getting ready to chime in. Didn't mean to interrupt, but I did want to welcome to listen to the show. Go ahead, Brian.
All right. So I was going to think about this, James. We do owe China a metric ton of money. What if they don't collect in monetary gain? What if they just want to collect in land?
Well, and unfortunately, Obama's letting them do that.
You're right.
I was doing some reading the other day that they control a large number of the ports in America. And that's the last I checked, and at least prior to President Obama, it was illegal for foreign nations to own property like that in America. But somehow, I guess it must have been a magical executive order that allowed that to happen. And it appears that we are literally selling the nation to the Chinese government.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, to go even farther back on some other things I wanted to chime in on, you were talking about, like, the police state arriving and the disconnect between the youth and the police today. I think that the disconnect is even larger between the youth who are on the police force and the people who are veterans of the police force, because we're not taught the Constitution in high school anymore. We're not taught about civil rights. We're not taught that we can do things, that we have these inalienable rights that we're born with. So people are joining the police force. People are joining the military. People are joining these organizations where they're supposed to uphold and support the Constitution above everything else. They're taking this oath, and they have no idea what it means.
Well, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. They don't know what it means. And really, the only thing I can see as a solution to this problem is well, number one, making civics a required course in schools again, where the Constitution is the primary topic. I would go so far as to, you know, make it a patriotism class, and you could do that without propaganda. You could do that without tainting it. I mean, simply give history and the facts, the real facts, not the Common Core garbage,
mm-hmm.
where it's calling the members of the Boston Tea Party terrorists, because we aren't the British. And the British can feel free to call us terrorists for that act because, well, they lost that war, and they can call us whatever they want. But the fact is, from an American perspective, and that's where we are, the people that did the Boston Tea Party and threw those tons of tea, you know, over taxation into the Boston Harbor, from our perspective, were not terrorists. And every textbook that's written that states that need to be used for bonfire fodder because they're worthless for anything else.
Our textbooks, I mean, don't give us accurate facts about anything. They have these, like, sob stories about, you know, pseudo-founding fathers, people who discovered America. They give all the credit to Columbus, and they don't even tell you the real story behind Columbus, and he was, like, this rich dude. They tell you he was poor, and his crew was going to mutiny, and America was the last resort, and if they don't find it, then everybody's screwed. But in reality, it wasn't like that at all.
And real quick, Brian, I want to just say to the folks, I do have just a little over a minute of live time, so we will be going into the extended version, as we do many times here on the Bard's Logic Political Talk, and that's fine. All that we'll do is that it'll shut off the air for the people listening live, but if you do want to listen in to the extended version, call 347-945-7428 and push 1 on your number dial if you'd like to chime in or send me a message through the chat or on Facebook to let me know that you'd like to come in. But for those who will not be listening to the extended version, thank you very much for coming to the show tonight. I hope you enjoyed, and please share the link to folks. You can even email it, download it on CD, and people listen to that on iPhones and smartphones, things of that nature.
And also check out the website, www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. So thank you very much for coming to the show, and you can listen to the archive to hear the rest of the extended version after the show ends from the extended version. So take care for the next vote. Have a good night, and hope to see you again. We are now about starting to the extended version tonight. So go ahead, Brian, and then what I'd like to do after that is to open the mic back up to you, Kelly. Go ahead. Brian?
So back to what I was saying, we aren't taught the truth anymore. And like the saying goes, history is written by the victors. America has either won or withdrawn from every war it's ever been in. Therefore, we have the pens. You know what I mean? Like, we tell our people exactly what we want them to know. We teach them just enough to be slaves to a system. We give them just enough money to be slaves to a system. We give them just enough freedom to start believing they're free. And then they trap us in these boxes. That's what our houses are. Like, we must have a house. We got to be measured by our statuses. We got to get more money and support this candidate because he's going to do this. And then in all reality, we get so caught up with our own shit. I don't know if I can say that. I'm sorry.
Yeah, but, I prefer not, but...
I'm sorry. But we get caught up with all of our own stuff that we forget about what's really going on in the world. And then people like Barack Obama, George Bush, Clinton, Bush Sr. all come into office and push this New World Order agenda consecutively. And we end up with a police state, we end up with false flag terrorist attacks, we end up with two wars in foreign countries, and our sons and our daughters coming home in boxes with flags over them. And we don't get anywhere. We spend more money than we make. And we sell this country out from underneath its citizens before they're even born. I mean, we come into this world owing 40 grand.
Wow. Yep, that's right.
And I'm wondering why there are not thousands of people in every city. Screw overpasses. We should be flooding the streets.
Hmm.
We should look like a civil rights activist protest march in D.C. with hundreds of thousands of people just surrounding the White House, yelling and screaming with their signs, making a noise. But instead, we struggle to put 20 people on an overpass in six cities per state. And people wonder why people are arrested on the overpasses, and we wonder why we're not loud enough.
That's for certain. I don't think we're loud enough. I think people are discouraged. They think that, you know, there are folks out there who did fight the good fight, and they feel like they're not going anywhere. I mean, a lot of those folks who were fighting on our topic earlier tonight with the RNC meeting, trying to get the rules changed to keep the grassroots influence in the Republican Party. And it seems like for naught. They're giving up their time, their treasure, blood, sweat, and tears, so to speak, for it. And then the powers that be just keep squashing them down. It makes people wonder, you know, well, you know, it makes them, you know, apathetic for it. I'm not by any way defending that. You got to keep on, you know, keep on fighting, just perhaps find a better angle, or even more so than a different angle. It's not as much the angle that's bad as that you need more push behind that wedge, behind that angle to get these things to move. And so we definitely need massive numbers, as you suggested, Ryan. But I'd like to bring the mic back to Kelly, since we haven't heard from Kelly for a while, and then we'll bring it to Constantine, and then you, James.
Well, Ryan, I'm with you in so many of your perspectives. I'm up here in Northern California, and I'm just very honored to be on the phone with someone who is standing up for the problems we're facing. And by the way, this is a call out to everybody, not just Brian, but I'm here in Siskiyou County. That's Northern California. We're right on the Oregon border. We're larger than some of the eastern states. And we've got a sheriff here who came to the Tea Party last night, and they just loved him. He loves our Constitution. He knows what's going on. He's an oath keeper. We've had him on the show. This is a safe haven, folks. All right? It's another invite. A little wink, wink, nudge, nudge to get up here. Anyway, and we're getting, you know, kind of friends of the sheriff together. know, emergency comes, he's going to need men. So anyway, yeah, Brian, I wanted to throw out to you another option you may not have known that you had. I wrote this book about the great power of the grand jury, and one of the great stories I saw was when our grand jury, you know, this really applies to California, the other states, we've got challenges that we're hopefully going to overcome. But in 1988, our district attorney here in Siskiyou County wasn't doing his job. Good Old Boys Network brought him up out of the middle of California, got him appointed as, or elected as the district attorney. He was letting child abusers off. A two-year-old was murdered. He did nothing. Somebody submitted a complaint that ended up in the hands of the grand jury here, and he indicted the district attorney, Charles Sloat, and they also indicted his second-in-command, John Marshner. So you imagine a situation where a group of everyday people like you and me on a grand jury get this complaint. They did about a six-month investigation along with other duties they had, but about 6 months later they came out with an indictment, and it hit the papers. And, of course, the district attorney is indicted. What happens? Cuff him, stuff him, throw him in the slammer.
Yeah.
That actually happened. Well, I found it in our local library. Somebody told me about this. I was in the library, and I found it on microfiche. I'm like, woohoo! My, oh, whoops, this is a library. But this is another option you have, Brian. There's a civil grand jury. I mean, obviously, you're in Bakersfield. Are you in Kern County?
Fresno. I'm in Fresno County.
Fresno County, okay. All right, so you're in Fresno County, and there's quite a little bit of tricks to this, because they will tell you, and this is by practice, it's not written policy. In fact, the state statutes say it a little differently, and the case law is definitely a lot stronger. But you can submit a petition to your civil grand jury, and before you do that, we have got to talk, because the person that will be advising that grand jury is county council. Oh, wait a minute. The grand jury's job is to investigate the offices of the county, and you have the county council advising the grand jury? No, don't investigate these guys. They're my buddies.
Yeah.
Anyway, yeah, that's one of the few flaws. The California system is very good. You know, here in Tule Lake, a public official, the news came out in January, she was a clerk receiving money for the city of Tule Lake. Well, the grand jury found out that she's taking the money and putting it in her pocket. Eventually, the district attorney got involved, she got arrested, plea bargain, all that kind of stuff. That's what the grand jury does. It's everyday people like you and me, and they have enormous power. The reason why I'll ask you, Brian, have you ever heard of this before?
Heard of what? Grand
about
jury?
The power, yeah.
Not too familiar with it, but I have, like, a grazed over stuff. But I'm not very familiar with it at all, no.
Yeah, well, the grand jury started at Magna Carta. And they were in place, the Baron group of 25 bragged for over, was it 80 or 90 years, that they were the protectorate of the people from the abuses of the king. Eventually, a parliament took over, 1215 Magna Carta, 1300 legislature, which was the parliament, elected. But it existed before the legislature system. And that is your right of petition, but that takes too long to explain. And we don't need it in California, because when you submit a complaint, it goes directly to the grand jury. I've submitted these. I got a letter back from the grand jury foreman. It was rather nice. You also have, to your advantage, a new grand jury was convened in July. So they have to serve 1 year, so they have time to investigate your situation. And I would be glad to help you, because we need to put additional things in there so that the county council doesn't say, you can't indict these people. Oh, yes, they can. A packet, you know, you tell your whole story, your video, and basically instructions. And look, grand jury, you guys have this power. Now indict these sons of bitches and throw them in the slammer. The Rodney King situation. You know, everybody knows about Rodney King. Well, the grand jury then indicted the officers. Officer David Warren of New Orleans Police Department, during Katrina, he killed somebody. Mr. Glover was shot Mr. Warren thought he was looting, and he wasn't. He was an innocent person, lots of witnesses. And so the internal investigation by the police department, the report was that, oh, we found his body burned in a car on a levee. End of report. We can't. There's no evidence. So that was our internal investigation. Grand jury found out and indicted not just David Warren for murder, his partner, and the two lieutenants who were all involved in covering it up.
Oh man.
Yeah. So this power exists. Most people don't know about it. California. Somebody decades ago worked very hard to get our statutes to where they are, where there's no gatekeepers. There's some influence. But I can help you, and I would love to see the front page in your local paper, these jokers that did this to you get indicted, and they go to jail.
Oh, I would love to see that, too.
That'd be great.
So,
no, go ahead, Kelly. I want to open up the mic.
Well, yeah, Robert can exchange our information. You know, Robert, go ahead and give him my phone number, and we can talk.
Okay.
But I want to kick these people's asses. I mean, this is getting so bad, there's a website called Cop Block.
I actually am a huge supporter of them, and I have them wearing one of their T-shirts.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, because, I mean, this is going on all over the country. I mean,
Freeman is a hero.
Oh, yeah, another story. Another story that happened.
Go ahead, guys.
Another story of just police brutality.
Real quick, Kelly, we can get to that, and I will get the information exchange between you two, but I did want to bring Constantine back on, you know, see if we'd like to chime in on anything so far.
Okay.
So your mic is open. There you go.
Oh, it's me again? Okay.
Yeah.
Well, there was a 96-year-old man who was killed in his nursing home room.
I was talking to Constantine, and
oh,
then
sorry.
We'll bring him up. That's okay.
Okay.
To bring you back,
right.
Okay.
I leave all the mics open, Constantine. So I never muted your mic. So, and I like to try to.
Oh, I thought you couldn't hear me. I'm sorry. Okay. Well, anyway, first of all, I do need a little bit about it, actually, about grand juries. And the thing about grand juries in most states is, basically, what the district attorney does is he gets it's just like any other jury. They send you out notices and you serve on it. And basically, it's a cheerleading session where the district attorney or one of his assistants explains the case and why this person should be prosecuted. And in most states, you can't even be present or even know that you're going before the grand jury, and the problem with that, and the thing is, what's been happening, especially here in Texas as a whole, but also it's the guy that's our district attorney here is notorious for it. It's like there are certain cases he has to bring before the district attorney, but he doesn't have to fervently try to convince them to convict, indict, and say, this is supposed to be a checks and balance measure, but the problem is if you can't defend yourself and the only person there to say anything, and there's a saying which kind of gives you an idea. The district attorney was trying to indict me. There's a saying here in Texas: you can indict a ham sandwich. It took five times to indict me.
Yeah,
But here's the thing, and I've been doing this for years, and this started. They dragged this out for 3 years. I get appointed an attorney, and within 5 weeks, I had my trial. He wouldn't ask for a continuance because the one before it, just dragged it out. Me keeping saying, I want my trial now. I have a right to speedy trial and all that business. Well, they never did it. They just kept finding reasons not to have it. And all of a sudden, the guy, I get a new attorney appointed, and he just is a friend of the person that I ran against and just didn't want to do anything. You've got to be careful about that, because the thing is the problem with this, it may be right, wrong, or different, but it's legal. I mean, he could have every right in the state of Texas to do that, and that's what I've when I talk to some people at the state bar, it's like, well, what can you say? I mean, you don't have a right to be there if the district attorney, even in cases where there are certain criminal charges, if they're filed by certain agencies, he has to present it the grand jury, but he doesn't have to do a good job.
Yeah.
Right. Right. Well, yeah. You know, let me address all this, okay? Because, you know, writing a book is one thing, is getting out there, pounding the pavement, telling people, and I'm getting feedback from all over the country, the district attorney will not submit the complaint, like with this 96-year-old man that was killed in his nursing home room because he wouldn't get a surgery. There's a story about this. I actually talked to the attorney that's representing the remaining family. This is what he said. Well, you know, I've worked with grand juries, and the district attorney is not going to submit to a grand jury. I said, you know, I know you were going to say that. I knew you would. So, well, they only do it when they only submit the complaints to the petitions to grand juries when it's they can get rid of a political opponent or if there's an enormous public outcry. Yeah, I knew you were going to tell me that. It is not the district attorney's choice. It is not that there was a landmark case, 1985. A federal judge says you will submit this to the grand jury. I mean, the thinking federal prosecutor could have just walked from his cubicle over to the grand jury, and boom, somebody wanted me to get this to you. That's, it would have taken, what, half an hour? No,
yeah.
He probably spent 50, 60 hours defending this in court. No, I'm the one in charge of the grand jury, not you. And that is not even true. Do you know why?
Why?
Because, okay, I'm going to go to John Jay's words eventually. Magna Carta, there was no mention of the attorney involved. You go straight to the grand jury. That's it. Done. John Jay said in his charge to the Richmond Grand Jury, 1793, it is your job to investigate the offenses of the laws of the United States, and which is, you know, treaties, constitutional laws passed by Congress. It's your job. He said it very clearly twice. Why didn't he charge the district, the prosecutor? Because there wasn't one. The way it worked in our country before and after the Revolutionary War, after the Constitution, was there was no federal prosecutors getting involved and growing into the position of a gatekeeper. In 1870, that's when the Justice Department was formed. Now, our right of petition is to a grand jury. Bureau of Duryea versus Garneria, 2011 case. Adderley versus Florida, 1966 case. And this most recent one of 85, which is finally somebody put a head to it, and yeah, the gosh damn prosecutors are being a gatekeeper, but what they are doing, these court cases define that a right to petition goes back to Magna Carta. There was no legislature in existence at the time. There was no parliament. What these gatekeepers have done, and this is a big picture, folks, what these gatekeepers have done is they prevent and they block a petition to a grand jury, and in doing so, they protect their corrupt political allies. Government grows, corruption grows, and the people cannot look and hold our government accountable. In Georgia, it was either DeKalb or Decatur County. There's some corruption going on, so they got a grand jury going. Okay, great. They start snooping around, find this person's in on it, that person's in on it. The chain went all the way to the judge that was overseeing the grand jury, and the grand jury indicted the judge.
Dang.
This is recent. Yes, this is recent. But 9 out of 10 people do not know this power. So, Brian, when we are submitting this, you know, I'm glad to help you. It's your choice. We need to tell the grand jury, and I've got the documents, that you're in charge. And in California specifically, when the grand jury is deliberating, the statutes require that the judge and any prosecutor is not in that room. And the grand jury is their own show. Hey, we're deliberating. The judge comes in, get out. What? Yeah, right here, penal code, get out. And then walks in the district attorney or county counsel, get out. Here it is in the penal code. And that is why Charles Sloat, our district attorney, he didn't even know he was being investigated by the grand jury. When he found out was when he had handcuffs on his hands. I mean,
So I'm
glad to help you. Robert, just give him my phone number and all. And I want to see, you know, like the 96-year-old that was killed by the cops, you know, he was tasered, and he was a beanbag shotgun. They got him. He bled to death. It's like, dude, if he's hostile, just leave the room. I mean, come on. What's he going to do, crawl after you on his
walker?
I'm going to get you, son of a bitch. The cops couldn't kill me. Come on. The cops could have ran away. No, they killed him.
Wow.
This is our police state, folks.
And real quick, folks, I did see that James Neighbor from the Overpasses for Obama's Impeachment had to go, and I want to thank you, Mr. Neighbors, for coming on to the show tonight and sharing us the updates about the Overpasses for Obama's Impeachment, and we'll hope to get you back on the show again. So thank you very much for the time that you spent with us tonight. So I just want to give the goodbyes for the folks from Mr. Neighbors. So go ahead, Kelly. Sorry to interrupt, but I just want to put that out there.
Oh, well, anyway, in California, it's really easy. It goes directly to the grand jury. And there's tricks to make sure that you know that they've gotten your complaint, your petition. It's basically, please send me a confirmation of receipt letter. That way you know it's not intercepted, blocked, whatever. In other states, we're working on the right of petition with this landmark case. I've had an attorney look at it. I got a friend who's editing this document. It's somebody else has asked me to write an amicus curiae for their situation. So anyway, spent a lot of research on it because this thing is so powerful. The powers that be, number one, don't want you to know it exists. Number two, they do everything they can to make sure the grand jury doesn't get the petition. When they do, the prosecutor's in the room playing games, trying to influence Hawaii. Hawaii has a statute that if the grand jury requests, they get independent prosecution. So there are, I'm trying to overcome and combat this bullshit. A buddy and I were working on a petition or a statewide referendum to more empower and clarify the grand jury. So I want to see these officers that did this to you. I want their asses kicked and put in the very jail cell that they put you in.
Oh yeah. Oh yeah. You can't treat people that you swear to protect and serve and you're supposed to be there for when they need you. I mean, another thing, going all the way back to the gun grab that people were talking about, getting us disarmed. It's like when the seconds count, the police are only minutes away. Like, you have to be able to take care of yourself. You know what I mean?
Right,
you have
right.
to look out for yourself because Officer Blue, he's not going to be there for 20 minutes. And when he does show up, he's got more of a chance of shooting you than he does the bad guy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've read all the stories about cops and how they shoot, but there was a dude who broke up with his girlfriend, and his girlfriend called the cops because he had a marijuana grow in his basement. So the cops came at 2:30 in the morning and tore this dude's door down. So he woke up thinking he was being raided for his bud and grabbed his gun. The cops put 230 rounds into the master bedroom, hit the man two times. He put 15 or 16 rounds out his door. Now, if it's a 15-round mag, then he only had one mag. But if it was a 10-round mag, which the majority of civilians are going to carry, he did a reload in the middle of a firefight, still killed one cop and injured six others with two mags. These cops put in excess of 203 bullets into this guy's room and hit him twice. They're doing more damage than they're stopping. We need to get gun control in the hands of the police.
Wow, well stated. Gun control is the ability to shoot what you aim at. Did the guy survive?
I think he did. He was arrested. He took 2 9-millimeter bullets, like somewhere in the body. I'm sure he's in a lot of pain, but he lived.
Wow.
But I mean, the simple fact that you can come in the middle of the night, unannounced, into somebody's home and initiate battle is ridiculous.
Yeah, it's freaky.
I mean, you would read
question.
About that in Afghanistan. You wouldn't read about that in Missouri.
Jeez.
Mm-hmm. I was wondering if I could ask you something. The thing is, you know, as I said, I was really had no choice. I had to plead no contest because it certainly wasn't going to be a contest. Since then, every job opportunity I've had, they've refused to allow me to go. I know it sounds amazing, but I actually do voice work, you know, and they won't let me go anywhere. And the thing is if I don't pay the court cost, it's a violation of my probation. And of course, you know, earlier on, you know, I used to write articles about stuff. I wrote an article about how our county sheriff had not been investigated because a number of girls all between the ages of 16 and 12 that accused him of, like, sexual assault or forcing them to do sexual favors because he had caught them, you know, some kind of minor offense or something like that. And ever since that, you know, I really haven't gotten a lot of help, obviously, from the sheriff's department here. And the problem is he swore and he promised that I would not complete my observation. You know, I mean, I've had legitimate job offers, you know, to go work other places. They won't let me go. You know, they're making me destitute. You know, I have some medical issues I really need to take care of. I can't afford to pay it. I can't hardly afford to pay the $50 a month, you know, for my thing. I need some help. I mean, do I just have no rights anymore? They can just treat me any way they want to. I mean, I'm at the end of my rope, you know. And I mean, I'm not a whiner per se, but I'm looking at, you know, that they said that they will not rest until I'm in prison, you know, because, you know, I wrote articles about the good old boy system here and then just exposed the corruption. That's all I did. I mean, I was nice about it, actually. I never called people names or anything like that. And I really need help. I just don't know where to go. The the ACLU isn't going to come out here. They said it doesn't really matter how viable a case you have out there, the county that you live in, there's no chance that it ever sees the light of day in a courtroom. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe there's somebody else that I could talk to, but literally, you know, there's no way I'm going to last 5 years. I mean, they're going to put me in prison. You know, it's just a matter of time.
That's okay. You're back on. Sorry, guys. Just want to let you know, I've got James Neighbors back on here through three-way calling. Normally, when we go into the extended period, we can't get people to call back in, just how things are set up in the studio. But, however, by technology, I was able to use the three-way calling here and get it back on. So, James, welcome back to the show. Guys, finish off here, and then I'd like to open the mic up back here for James to chime in. So, go ahead, guys.
I've actually got a question for James.
Sure, go ahead.
So no answer? So no answer?
I'm here.
He's there.
Hey, James, it's Brian. I got a question I was thinking about last week.
Well, I'm sorry I wasted my time, gentlemen. You have a good night.
I'm sorry?
Hello?
Did he say he wasted his time?
That's what I thought.
He dropped the call. I don't understand what happened there.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. Wow. Okay.
I don't understand. I know he said he was needing. I was working on getting you back on, James, and he.
I was gone for a whole 5 minutes. My gosh.
And he said. He was talking. If you guys can revamp me, he's talking about needing some help with something, and then I brought James back on, and then he wanted to ask him a quick question. I thought that was fine. He goes, "Well, sorry for wasting my time or something like that," and he hung up. I mean, did I miss something?
I don't think so.
What did I miss? That.
I don't know. Well, what was he saying that he needed help with, Kelly?
Well, I'm just kind of listening. That's all.
Okay. No, but I thought I overheard him saying he was needing some help with something, or he was telling us something.
I missed it.
Oh, okay.
No, I actually didn't mean to drop the call. I was moving the phone and hit the hang-up button. And just, you know, wasn't trying to waste his time either.
Yeah, I didn't. I don't understand what that was about. If you listen to the archive through this, you know, sorry about that. Maybe he's still in the chat there either. I could have sent him a chat message. Well, I apologize. Hopefully he listens to the archive and here's my apologies for for missing that. I just want to make sure that we were able to bring you back onto the show, James, because you dropped the show, and I just wanted to do that. I didn't mean to cut him off. I don't like to cut anybody off. That was just something I was working on when you sent me the message there on Facebook. And speaking of Facebook, I'll use this shameless time to promote the Bard's Logic Political Talk page and group that folks can check out on Facebook. Just go to the search engine and put in Bard's Logic Political Talk and like the page and join the group. So once again, sorry for the guy for taking off. I hope he didn't really think that he wasted his time. I don't think he did. I'll go back in the archives and listen to what he was talking about and perhaps try to reconnect with him and make amends, I guess. But go ahead, Brian. You said you had a question for James, and we'll move on. We do have about, I'd say, about 25 minutes left of the extended version before I shut things down. So a little bit less than that. So go ahead, Brian.
So James is not here then?
No, I am here.
Okay, you are here. All right. I was confused as to whose time got wasted.
I'm not sure what happened there either, so that was, yeah. At any rate, go ahead.
All right, my question for you, James, is obviously the main goal of overpasses is the impeachment of Obama, but you have sparked a fire under 50,000 people in America, and what are you planning to do with it? If Obama's impeachment does not happen and we run into the 2016 campaign, or B, Obama's impeachment does happen, I mean, is the overpasses movement just going to be over if Obama's impeachment is a success? Or are you continue with this massive activist group that you've started?
No, it's actually the plan is definitely not to end things, successful or otherwise. Our next target, our goal after Obama, whether successful or otherwise, is cleaning up Congress. Working on statewide levels and basically aiming our resources at removing corrupt politicians like Feinstein and Reid and John Boehner and McCain, and we could go on. There's about 535 people in Congress, and probably 525 of them need to go. And that's really. The long term outlook of it is I'd like to see overpasses continue really beyond even my lifetime, beyond Brian's lifetime, when we're old and gray and retired, and have overpasses continue as a watchdog group to assure actual transparency and honesty in the government, where we have the type of government that we're supposed to have, to help get the right politicians in office that will cut our federal government, to pare it back to the small size that it was originally intended. The fact is the founding fathers only intended for our government to do three things. That was to provide national defense, to provide diplomatic efforts to foreign nations, and to serve as a mediator between states that were having, sovereign states, and that's an important word, sovereign states that were having squabbles between one another. That was the entire purpose of the federal government. The elimination of the IRS. The fact is that prior to the inception of the IRS, the federal government had to go and beg the states for operating capital. And that's the way it should be. The federal government should be at the beck and call of the states, not the states at the beck and call of the federal government. And we need to return to that. It's a kind of a joke I like to, kind of a grim joke, I suppose, I like to say about Oklahoma the way the United States is supposed to be run is where each state kind of caters to its individual citizens. And that's like, just for example, let's say you like to smoke pot. You could go to Alaska, Washington, Oregon, California, or Colorado and you could smoke pot till your lungs explode and your eyes pop out, you know, but that's fine because it's legal there. And let's say just
added it.
Well, then let's add Washington, D.C. into that mix. Let's say, well, I guess Obama will be happy about that.
Yeah, the tomb gangs.
You know, and let's say, you like polygamy. Well, you could move to Utah for that, and because that's okay, because they're a sovereign state and they allow polygamy. Let's say you like gambling and prostitution. Well, you could go to Nevada. And let's say you want to go somewhere where the laws are so strict you could get convicted of a crime that would be a misdemeanor in any other state and end up with a life sentence. You could come to Oklahoma.
Kansas, too. No, I definitely understand what you're saying. I mean, I even want to take it a step farther and give more power to the people in the form of, like, as adults, you know, consenting adults, we should be able to enter into any type of social contract with one another as long as it's free of force, fraud, and coercion. I mean, it may not be the correct, you know, like, everybody may have different, like a different ideal for what they see, but, I mean, even the, like, the American government system, like, democracy is really just the 51% imposing its will on the 49%, and in the grand scheme of everything, that's immoral to pick a leader for somebody else, if you catch my drift.
Well, you know, the fact is you can look at the way the voting went this last time in 2012, and you could literally drive from Canada to Mexico and not touch a county that voted for Obama. And it was the, you know, up in the Chicago area and over on the East Coast and over on the West Coast and little spots in between. But if you were to look at a map of the way the electorate went, I mean, it's a sea of red with islands of blue in there. And that tells me that these metro areas, I mean, you know, maybe – just maybe they need to redo things where it's covered by, I don't know, mileage per person or acres per person or something to the effect. Because the fact is, you know, we've got these liberal strongholds, these leftists, these strongholds where they want everything handed out to them that are making the decisions for the rest of the nation. And that's not the way it was intended. There was not supposed to be these pockets of population that make the decisions for everybody else. And that quite simply has just got to be, we've got to do something. I don't know exactly what the answer is to that, but we can't have it where you can look at a map of the electorate and see that the vast majority of states in the country and counties in the country did not vote for Obama or vote for whoever, and that person wins. And another thing that we need to eliminate, and we need to actually step backwards to make sure it's done correctly, is we need to go back to paper ballots, you know, with a pen and a paper, and get rid of this electronic balloting. I mean, Anonymous proved, you know, just, you know, in an interesting act of benevolence when they hacked into the PlayStation 3s and the Xbox 360s and stole people's information, electronic data is not secure. And the fact that there were voting machines that were proven to vote only for Obama and that we had districts that over 140% of the voters, registered voters, were listed as voting specifically for Obama, and every single one of them voted for Obama. I mean, that's impossible. I mean, first off, to have more people voting than live in the county, and second, for it to be a 100% in favor of. But yet, even with that happening, Eric Holder said that these recount lawsuits were without merit. And there needs to be some sort of safeguard in there to where a corrupt attorney general can't prevent a recount when there's cases like that. Because it's obvious what happened is the election was stolen by election fraud and intimidation. I mean, when it's in the news during, you know, during the when the polls first opened in Philadelphia, where the new Black Panthers were throwing out Republicans from the polling stations, but yet nothing's done about this. There is no recount. I mean, Al Gore cried about hanging chads and gets a recount. We've got actual physical confrontations and altercations in polling stations, known computer fraud on voting machines, but yet there is no recount. We've got a serious issue going on in this country, and the only solution I could see to that would be go to paper recounts and or paper ballots and have a triple recount done in different counties, you know, that are unaware of what county they're even counting. You know, that way there's a triple blind count of the entire thing, and I don't believe media should be able to cover exit polls. It needs to be a completely blind election until it's over. There shouldn't be voter intimidation. Well, as of 6 o'clock, you know, Mitt Romney shows in the lead or whoever shows in the lead, you know, that shouldn't happen because that taints the election. It causes people to go out and it changes
right.
their... And that needs to end. If the election takes a week to get the tallies, the votes tallied up, but it's accurate, then that is what the important thing is.
Right. And Kelly, would you like to chime in on any of that? I haven't heard from you for a bit.
Oh my gosh, James, we got to talk. We got to talk. Robert, give him my number.
Yeah,
I'm working with a group.
Danger number as well.
Yeah. I'm working with a group that we started out Watch the Vote 2012. We saw these election fraud issues. One of our members saw that in Iowa, they just happened to add 20 votes to Mitt Romney at his caucus, and I knew that actually Santorum won before the media came out. And first time in American history that a political party had reversed its winner in a primary.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that way ahead of time. One of our people on the ground caught him. We got a lot of connections there. We hate electronic election machines. Mark Levin came out with a new book about his constitutional amendments. Number 11 is voter ID plus electronic election machines are prohibited. Most European countries have terminated their electronic machines. So it doesn't matter, you know, all of our hard work, all of what we do, it doesn't matter what our opinions are, how much we love the Constitution, if they're just going to electronically swap the vote, all of our work is in vain. And we've got some other strategies, too, like the precinct strategy, which, but yeah, gosh, we got to talk some more. But anyway, yeah. We got problems, you know, the beast needs to be slayed in multiple ways. The axe, the spear, the sword, the arrow, and the, you know, give me a 50 millimeter cannon. It doesn't matter. We just all have to work together.
Horn?
We got our focus. Is it what?
Was that a horn I heard?
A horn?
No, I heard a beep beep.
I don't know. I'm beep beep. I'm going off on my rant again, but
I heard a beep somewhere, like if you're outside or something.
Oh, well, I think that's when I said a 50-millimeter cannon. It went beep, beep. I don't know. But,
okay.
You know, NSA is not listening. Hey, guys, how are you doing? Hey, you know what? I've been to your – I had a buddy that worked there. I just – say hi to Marty for me. Anyway.
Shout out to the NSA.
Shout out to the NSA. Hey, yeah, keep us safe, but don't you dare touch our liberties.
Hey, Jeff, I'm just saying what's up, man. Brian from Fresno. I'll see you next year at the reunion.
Yeah. Anyway, that's kind of my closing thoughts there, is we have to slay the beast every way we can.
From what I gathered from listening to James and Kelly talk, it sounds like voting is like a placebo pill the American public takes every 4 years to calm their mind into thinking that we have control for the next 4 years. Am I on the right page here? I feel like I'm throwing my votes away now.
Well, yeah, that's the way it feels to me lately, too. I mean, you know, the fact that you know, the exit poll showed Romney clearly winning up until the last 2 hours in this last election. And then miraculously, well, I guess that's when the voting machines decided to change votes, you know, that he ended up losing. And it does, it just feels like we're going through the motions simply to placate the masses. And I mean, the entire election just felt completely illegitimate in every way. And the fact that our votes are counted by a company that's owned overseas, there's something very, very wrong about just the notion of that. And the fact that it's reality is just sickening. We should never have a foreign entity counting our votes in this country.
No,
that's for certain. Oh, my God.
Is it so absurd that a foreign entity counts our votes now? I mean, a foreign person is now governing our country. foreign people answer my phone calls at tech support.
Oh, my gosh. Don't take me there. I can't.
Is it really so absurd that something foreign now counts our votes?
Yeah, that's true. Even our votes have been even our vote counting has been outsourced.
I mean, Mitt Romney made his living outsourcing small businesses that were failing.
Oh, I tell you what, he was the absolute worst candidate to possibly go up against Obama. There's no way this green earth that Romney could have beat Obama. There's none. And he was the worst candidate for the Republicans to prop up to go up against Obama. There's no way. We talked
Nobody
about
would wise up. Nobody would wise up to the Ron Paul factor of, like, legitimate truth being attractive to America, like liberty being attractive to Americans, that the principles that this country was built on should be restored is somehow ugly in the eyes of Americans, and that nobody wants to hear about this, so we must give a media blackout to truth and liberty because that'll scare people or something.
Real quick, Brian, I'm still here on Facebook getting some messages during the show, and I have someone asking this, Cindy, and she's thank you for the message there from Facebook. And I'll ask Brian this question. Are you planning on doing any kind of maybe civil lawsuits against the CHP or anyone?
As of now, my only impression was that I could do civil lawsuits against CHP.
Okay.
I wasn't even aware that I had other lawsuit options. I was purely planning a civil suit.
You are? Okay. They were asking whether you were going to plan a civil suit or not.
Yeah, I mean, the only lawsuit I even thought I could plan was a civil suit.
Okay. Well, they didn't know whether you were doing it or not. They were actually were hearing about the show. They weren't able to listen to the show tonight, but they have been hearing about it. Some of the things we've been talking about on the show through posts on Facebook. And so through those posts and messages, they're getting the gist of what we're talking about. And so they're asking, without actually hearing the show, whether you're going to do a civil lawsuit. So,
well, they're actually, I'm trying to remember the exact code. It's Section 42, Article 93, I believe it is, where you can actually sue individual law enforcement officials for violating your civil rights. Your constitutional rights.
That's also affirmed in Bivens versus six unknown IRS agents. The famous Bivens actions. IRS agent comes to your office. Hey, sit down. I'd like to talk to you. You're going to talk to me about taxes. I'm going to talk to you about Bivens versus six unknown IRS agents. The guy will probably stand up and walk out.
And with that, guys, I hate to interrupt, I truly do, but I do see there's only like 9 minutes left of even the extended period. It's amazing how fast the shows go. And I really appreciate everyone with their input tonight on the show.
and I will get you guys connected together. So what I'd like to do is to give each one of you, starting with James, and then you, Brian, and then you, Kelly, to give some last-minute thoughts. Give it about a minute worth of last-minute thoughts, and then I will proceed to shut down the show. So go ahead, James.
Well, I would just like to encourage everybody to check us out there on Facebook at, you know, just search for Overpasses for Obama's Impeachment and go to our website at overpasses.org. And if you don't do Facebook, you can always find us also on the Tea Party community. And we'd love to have you aboard. We're going to be out there very strong on 9/11. And it's in opposition of this insane and insulting million Muslim march. The fact that they have zero respect for the people that died in this country. I mean, that's a sensitive day of mourning in this country. And they're slapping us in the face and spitting on the graves of the people that died in Benghazi and on the attacks of 9/11 2001, and the overpasses will not stand by and let them steal that day away from the American people. We refuse to do so. And if you'd like to stand up in opposition to those people, please check us out, because we will not let those people demand greater than equal rights in America without opposition to their wishes.
Thank you very much, James, for coming on to the show. You're always welcome to come in or call in on any of the shows, regardless. And go ahead, Brian.
I just want to say that, I mean, I'm 24, I'm a veteran, and we need to see more young people waking up to the fact of the matter that we are the ones in control now. We're the ones who are going to be making the legislation and the mandates in the future. So we're the ones who need to wise up now and take our stands and earn our places in the history books. I mean, the founding fathers during the revolution weren't wearing powdered white wigs and being justices. They were 24-year-old kids running around in Indian costumes, protesting and being radical, and people were calling them hippies and drug addicts and crazy waste of time libertarian kids like they call us. I mean, they weren't old during the revolution. They were 20, 19. One kid was 13. I mean, they were men at a very young age. We need to see that now in America, especially under today's current administration.
And thank you very much, Brian, and thank you very much for coming on to the show tonight and sharing with us your story. And I want to wish you the best of luck with that, and definitely keep me posted on any updates, and we'd be more than happy to have you back on the show to give us some updates on that. Thank you. And so while we go ahead, Brian.
If you just want to shoot Kelly's information to the Fresno Liberty Movement email address, and I'll get in contact with him.
Sure, yeah. What I'll do is I'll email you guys your phone numbers, because I have all your email addresses, and
yeah,
we'll
it's best to call
I'll
me.
Go from there.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah, I'll email the phone numbers.
Okay.
And Kelly?
Hey, liberty in two sentences. A good government acknowledges natural rights on paper. Sentence number two. We the people must execute mechanisms to enforce these rights. Now, of course, the government writing on paper our rights would be Declaration of Rights, 1765, 1774, Declaration of Independence, 1776, Constitution, Bill of Rights, statutes like 18 U.S.C. 242, and, of course, case law. That's the acknowledgement of our rights on paper. We the people must execute the mechanisms necessary to ensure our freedoms, which would include the voting box, the jury box, the right of free speech, the right of petition, the right to assemble, the right to the media, and of all these, and of course the grand jury, the right of petition,
if all these absolutely fail, then sadly it comes down to that last great box, which is called the bullet box, while at the same time equipping those great people who are in the first clause of the Second Amendment.
Indeed.
Thank you very much, Kelly, and I think that's a great way to end the show tonight, because I do say Bard's Logic Political Talk is the grassroots We the People show. And please check out the website at www.bardslogicpoliticaltalk.com. Check out the gift page and check out one of the organizations on there, especially, of course, all of them are great organizations. But most recently, the Angel Heart Farm. And just click on the red button that says Give to the Angel Heart Farm, and that'll take you to the website where you can help contribute to them. It's a great organization, nonprofit, that uses equine assisted therapy for children and their families facing a chronic or life-threatening illness. It's a great organization that helps out these children. And so thank you very much for listening to the show, folks. It will be great to see you again. And, of course, share the link with folks so they can listen to the show as well, and they can download it to multimedia ways of listening to the show, whether it's a phone or CDs or things of that nature, where people can listen to it and share it through emails, things like that. And so I will shut down, as I do every show, with the song by Aubrey Ashburn. And you can hear more of her music at www.aubreyashburn.com. And so thank you again. Take care. Good night. And see you again. Thank you.